In my last Dharma talk, I addressed the topic of what is the nature of Buddha nature. And I'm going to recap briefly some of the moves that I made in that lecture. My three lectures, even though they stand independently, are interconnected. So for those of you who have been so kind to attend the first two, you'll hopefully see some continuity. But if you didn't attend either of the previous lectures, that's okay, because what I want to say today can be taken on its own ground. Nevertheless, in taking up this question of what is the nature of Buddha nature, I took recourse to the thinking of Dogen Zenji, whom Roshi mentioned today in his Taisho, in order to help elucidate this simple but very complex question. So, without rehashing the arguments and positions that I presented before, let me begin by reiterating that Buddha nature is something that exists neither in the sense of being a phenomenal object nor as a purely conceptual entity. So Buddha nature is not something that we are able to locate in a being, nor is it merely a concept. But if that's so, then how are we to interpret the meaning of Buddha nature? This leads me to my topic today on emptiness and mind. I'm going to spend more time talking about mind than I am emptiness, but emptiness will certainly play a formative role in my comments. One possible path toward understanding the meaning of Buddha nature is to examine the phenomenon of mind. This concept has a very rich and complex understanding in Buddhist thinking. Early Buddhism, for instance, interpreted the Dharma primarily from what we today would call a psychological standpoint. This is really the focus of Theravada Buddhism, okay, the early way of the elders. And this understanding, this psychological understanding, was carried into later Mahayana Buddhism. And Mahayana Buddhism, for those of you that don't know, literally translates as the greater vehicle. And this is the Buddhist tradition that arose several hundred years after the life of the historical Buddha, when all of a sudden there was a proliferation of various texts that previously had been hitherto unknown. Various accounts were given as to why these texts all of a sudden started to appear. Some versions of this explanation were that, well, the minds of the Sangha at the time simply weren't ready to receive these deeper teachings. But from a more contemporary scholarly position, we simply assume that it's because as Buddhism began to grow and thinking about it began to develop, certain writers, certain Buddhist philosophers began to put their words down into writing, most notably people like Nagarjuna, who is often credited with having been the actual author of the Heart Sutra, even though we attribute it to the Buddha. Of course, Nagarjuna claimed that anything that he ever wrote or taught was nothing but a reiteration of the Dharma, of the original Buddha Dharma, that he neither added to it nor subtracted from it. According to one of these earlier sutras, the Ratnamegha Sutra, quote, all phenomena originate in the mind. And when the mind is fully known, all phenomena are fully known. The Bodhisattva, thoroughly examining the nature of things, dwells in ever-present mindfulness of the activity of the mind. and so he or she does not come under the mind's power. But the mind's power, rather, comes under his or her control. And with the mind under his or her control, all phenomena are under control. Now, certainly this notion of control isn't that of a will exercising some sovereignty over another weaker will. It's not control in the sense of domination, but rather, control here refers to discipline. And what type of discipline? Well, discipline in the sense of, for instance, right action, right mindfulness, and skillful means, upaya. The way, teaches the sage, is soft and yielding. And this is a reference to the Taoist influence of Zen, which often tends, I think, to get overlooked because of the far greater influence of Buddhism. But Zen would not be Zen as we know it if we didn't take into account the fact that Indian Mahayana interacted with Chinese Taoism and produced something new. This way, this is known from nature's teaching of Tao. And Tao is that which we often translate as way, sometimes as path. But from a Taoist perspective, way also signifies mind. Control is therefore the disciplined activity of not forcing the mind to construct reality, but rather yielding to its, and here's a paradoxical phrase, its active passivity. So that the illusory distinction between mind and body is ultimately abandoned, and with it, any false sense of inherent independence. This is the Buddha mind, which is also no mind, or mushin in Japanese. But this no mind doesn't mean a mind that is non-existent, but rather a mind that is fundamentally impermanent. Now, this is the thought that I ended my last Dharma talk with, Dogen's declaration that Buddha nature is impermanence. Now, there is, of course, a very long and variegated history in Buddhism attempting to grasp the Buddha mind in its true nature. And admittedly, it's beyond the scope of my remarks today to engage this history in any meaningful way. Suffice it to say that Zen, with its position regarding no mind and Huayan metaphysics, Huayan is another school of Buddhism. Huayan was, that's a Chinese term, was a school that developed, basing its teaching largely out of the Avatamsaka Sutra. And the core teaching of Huayan Buddhism is that everything in the cosmos can be grasped as a totality. So within the instant are contained all the moments of existence. It's a very metaphysical view, and one that places more emphasis on the notion of what we call suchness, or tathata, rather than the emphasis in Zen on emptiness, or shunyata. Philosophers, being types of people that they are, that we are, we love to draw distinctions. And centuries of very animated discussion ensued over the relationship between suchness and emptiness. This gets resolved to some degree in Zen, because from the Zen standpoint, particularly the Zen standpoint that developed in later China and then was transmitted to Japan. These distinctions, to use Dogen's term, simply fall away. We draw these distinctions because we tend to think of mind basically as our conscious reflective activity. But this is not the mind that the Buddha and the Bodhisattvas and the ancestors were referring to. Huayan metaphysics, with this emphasis on totality and the tradition of what was known in early Buddhism as the Tathagatagarbha. I talked about this in my very first lecture. Tathagatagarbha is the term that ultimately came to be identified with Buddha nature. What this term means literally, if you translate it, is either the seed or the womb, or one can say the embryo of the Buddha. And it's the idea that Buddha nature is something that we possess, and through our practice and greater realization come to an ever-growing understanding of, much like a seed that develops into a sprout and then later into a full plant or an embryo that becomes a child and then an adult. Whether adult or whether embryonic, it is still Buddha nature. But this Tathagatagarbha tradition seemed to suggest that awakening was something that was acquired, just as maturity brings to fullness the potential of what a thing is. This is different than the Zen understanding of awakening to our Buddha nature, which is construed to be original as opposed to acquired. This was the topic of my first talk, the difference between acquired and original awakening. So the argument then is, do we come to an understanding of Buddha nature as part of a process of which practice is an integral part, or is practice rather simply the expression, as Dogen would say, of our original realization? This has to do with the question of mind, because how we understand our relationship not only to practice, but to ourselves. And this makes me think much of what Bodhin was talking about today in his Keisho. Who are we? What are we? In a certain sense, this question immediately fails once it's even articulated. Because to even ask, who am I, or who are we, presupposes that there is some I or we that exists out there, or that can be identified or known. From a Zen standpoint, the question almost immediately begins to deconstruct itself, to unravel itself. The moment one asks the question, the moment one is confronted with the realization that mind is always, the ordinary mind, that is always constructing these dualisms in order to gain some level of understanding. But is this the mind that Buddhism talks about? And I would say that it is not. as would most of, or in fact all of the great thinkers that I've encountered. So to bridge my previous discussion of Buddha nature with my reflections today on emptiness of mind, I'll once again turn to Dogen Zenji for guidance. In characteristic fashion, Dogen employs mind in a variety of ways. He concludes his fascicle titled, or fascicle is a chapter titled Shishogi, meaning the meaning and verification of practice in his great work Shobogenzo, with the following statement. The Buddha Shakyamuni is mind itself is Buddha. When Buddhas of the past, present, and future together fulfill Buddhahood, they always become the Buddha Shakyamuni. This is mind itself is Buddha. We should carefully investigate who is meant when we say mind itself is Buddha. Mind you, he says, who is meant, not what is meant. This is how we repay the blessings of the Buddha. Following this Huayan interpretation, or following the Huayan interpretation, mind is the totality of all psychophysical realities. Roshi today mentioned the Yogacara, or mind-only or consciousness school of Buddhism. This was a fundamental influence on the development of Chinese Zen, or Chan. Drawing on this, Dogen also identifies mind with various levels of consciousness. Traditionally, there were 8 levels of consciousness that were designated, such as, for example, the mental activities of intellect, feeling, will. However, just as he did with the concept of Buddha nature, Dogen extends the concept of mind to include the exterior world. He wasn't the first to do it, but he probably was the one that did it most persuasively, certainly most influentially. Previously, notions of Buddha nature, Buddha mind, were confined to sentient beings. But as a result of the influence of Taoism, the notion of Buddha nature and even mind was extended to include the external non-sentient world. Nature, even the non-organic, such as rocks or mountains. Moreover, Dogen also identified mind with Dharma nature, Buddha nature, Shunyata, emptiness, and Tathata. He writes, quote, all things and all phenomena are just one mind. That is the thusness of mind as the all-embracing aspect of the universe. That thusness is this Tathata. Nothing, therefore, is excluded or unrelated. It's taught that all the Dharma gates are equally one mind and there is no differentiation. This is how Buddhists understand mind nature. So for Dogen, mind is simultaneously knowledge and reality, simultaneously subject and object, simultaneously self and other. As Roshi stated today, there really is no other. Buddhism is a view that is founded on a notion of totality. There's nothing outside the totality. Buddha nature is not something transcendent. Mind is not something that overlays reality. but rather Buddha nature, mind, Dharma, permeate everything that is. So that these distinctions between self and other, this and that, good and bad, mind and no mind, simply become at times delusional. There was a tradition in India called Advaita Vedanta, and it's largely associated with the great Indian thinker Shankara. Shankara wasn't a Buddhist, but he came as close to a Buddhist standpoint as Hinduism, you know, ever arrived. He wasn't a monist, he said. That is, his idea of the totality of mind or Buddha nature, or what we would call Buddha nature, was not something that could be described in positive terms as a unity. Because once you do that, make that move, you've already begun to substantialize what mind or Buddha nature is, and thereby relate to it by distinguishing it from what it is not: non-totality, non-unity. Rather, Advaita Vedanta meant non-dualistic. Now, it may seem that this is just a semantic difference. What's the difference between monism, non-dualism, between unity, non-dual? But it has to do with the orientation of one's thought. Non-dual. Not one, not two, not three. The Buddha used the phrase neti neti. Not this, not that. That is the moment where we are brought, if you will, face to face with the limitations of our capacity to understand on the basis of language alone. So like this Advaita Vedanta thinking of Shankara some five centuries earlier, Dogen also stressed the non-dual nature of mind as a way of negotiating the proper understanding of what eventually became the principal position of Mahayana Buddhism as a whole, that of Madhyamaka, or the middle way. That's Nagarjuna's term. Nagarjuna is counted in the lineage of the Buddha ancestors, and is in many ways arguably the most formidable thinker in the line of Buddhist history. The middle way. Of course, we know this term already from the Four Noble Truths. That is the Eightfold Path, the middle way. But for Nagarjuna, it meant something a little bit more akin to this notion of non-dual. So mind, then, is neither to be understood as some sort of monistic pantheism. Pantheism is the term that refers to the divine in everything. Nor is it a naturalistic pantheism. It's neither an all-embracing, pervasive metaphysical principle, nor is it simply extending the concept of ordinary mind to some higher cosmic level. This is arguably, at least according to some Western philosophers, what the Western ontological metaphysical tradition has done with the concept of God. the 19th century German philosopher Ludwig Feuerbach, said that God is simply a projection of the human ego, of the human mind. But mind, in the Buddhist sense, is not just an elevation or a perfection of human mind. While mind comes in and out of existence, as do all things, it's not merely coextensive with the totality of beings, but rather, in a sense, to use Dogen's phrase, it goes beyond them. One could say it transcends, but that's a tricky word because transcendence always tends to lead us to a position of dualism. And yet transcendence is also a good term because it signifies, by its basic etymology, a sense of moving beyond a certain standpoint. Early 20th century Japanese philosopher Keiji Nishitani referred to transcendence as transcendence, a movement beyond that takes us back to the imminence of the here and now. And that's, in a sense, how I see the trajectory of mind. Mind is that which is always bringing us back to the here and now, because only then is it possible for us to have direct experience. If it's taking us somehow beyond the here and now, then it can't be direct. Direct is always what returns to the self. That self which is paradoxically not a self, or what we call no self. However, neither is mind to be indiscriminately identified with Buddha nature, though in a sense they are indeed one. Certain esoteric forms of Buddhism, such as Tantrism, hold the position that the body itself is Buddha. But Zen adopts the position that mind is Buddha. But how is it that if the mind is Buddha, Dogen warns us not to identify them? Are we just sort of playing word games here, running in circles? It's not the body. Mind is Buddha. But then Dogen is saying, don't identify mind and Buddha. What does that mean? No, I'm sure Roshi didn't intend it this morning, but stole one of my quotations here. But it's such a great one that I'm going to state it again. And it's from Dogen. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things. When actualized by myriad things, your mind and body, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drop away. No trace of realization remains, and this no trace continues endlessly. No trace of realization remains, and yet this no trace continues endlessly. Since all things are continually moving and impermanent, the self, which is to say, the wild movements of the mind, let's define the self for the moment as the wild movements of the mind. Not simply as the body, not simply as consciousness inhabiting extended substance. The wild movements of the mind constantly moves to find a place of non-movement. This is the desire for permanence. This is the source of suffering. Last time, the question came up regarding whether or not non-sentient existence suffers. Duane brought up the example of a venerable tree that was damaged in a storm. We struggle with the notion of suffering. And I think this is really the heart of Buddhist teaching, is how to grapple with suffering. But the word that was traditionally defined as suffering, dukkha, when Shakyamuni in the First Noble Truth says all life is dukkha, really means all life is transient. That's the actual meaning of dukkha. It's how we deal with the ever-changing nature of our existence that constitutes our suffering, or not. Moving to this place of non-movement is what the self desires. And while it sounds as though this may be a movement towards rest and realization, it's actually a movement toward that which causes suffering. What the self desires most is a sense of permanence, a sense of being anchored in a sea, in the turbulent sea of existence. This is why so often we take recourse to metaphysical conceptions of reality. Precisely what the Buddha was admonishing his followers not to do. Non-ego, no self, anatman, was just another way of saying no Brahman, no absolute, no God in that sense of that which is permanent and fixed and which anchors our identity as being substantial and somehow permanent. The absolute, if we can use that term, Buddha nature, is precisely the emptiness of all permanence. Hence Buddha's, or Dogen's, declaration, Buddha nature is impermanence. The wildness of the mind then, that is our self, is not that of being so much ever-changing. Rather, the wildness of the mind is that which signifies the desire or craving for permanence in a world of impermanence. Awakened beings continually practice because practice is itself the way, not because practice brings you to an other standpoint. To understand the other shore of Buddhism in that sense is to misinterpret it. That other shore is not in a different time, in a different space. That other shore is already present. In a certain sense, we can say that we already walk on the other shore. We just need to realize it. And when we realize it, that other shore is no longer other. There's only the shoreline of our world. Awakened beings continually practice because practice is the only way. To do otherwise, though it too is the way, is not to realize the way. And this is what Roshi was talking about today. It's not to confirm. That was the term he was using today. To confirm the way. That's what I mean by realize. Without this realization, without this confirmation, the mind does not fall away. And our true nature, Buddha nature, is not seen. Let's return to the opening sentence in the chapter on Buddha nature. I touched on this last time. I just want to revisit it briefly. Here we find Dogen rereading a well-known passage from the Mahaparinirvana Sutra. And this sentence reads, "All sentient beings possess Buddha nature without exception." In Chinese, the verb to possess, to have, is the same. But it can also be read in Chinese, and this is the way Dogen renders it, all existences are Buddha nature. Not have, not possess, but rather they are. And so we find Dogen modifying both the notion of Buddha nature and of sentient beings, and thereby liberating the idea or the thought of Buddha nature from anthropocentric and biocentric perspectives. All existences is equated with both Buddha nature and sentient beings. In other words, it is at least, in part, a matter of conception, of realizing the true nature of mind. Now, this is what early Buddhist philosophies tended to do. They confined the concept of Buddha nature to sentient beings, beings that can feel, beings that think, and taught that sentient beings move towards enlightenment as something to be possessed or attained. But Dogen rejects these positions, and he expands this notion of Buddha nature, and with it, the notion of mind, to include, as I said before, both sentient and non-sentient beings. Well, how is this possible? That is because Buddha nature is self-creating. And this self-creation is a perpetual recreation. So the wild movements of the mind, rather than seeking a standpoint of rest or permanence, of tranquility, are actually able to be, if you will, harnessed by allowing the mind to embrace or grasp this idea of self as being in a state of perpetual recreation. Many of you are probably familiar with the famous Oxfording pictures. There are different versions of it, right? And it describes, depending on the version, 10, maybe sometimes 12 scenarios of moving towards state of awakening. And if you're not familiar with it, it begins with a man, a boy, who's looking for his ox. And eventually he sees traces of it, footprints. Eventually he glimpses the ox. Eventually he's able to put a yoke around the ox's neck. Eventually he's able to ride the ox without the yoke. Eventually, the ox and the shepherd disappear. And according to some versions of it, that's where it ends. The empty circle, moo. But later versions of these ox herding pictures end with the person being back in the marketplace, back in the world. Because awakening isn't a movement beyond. That other shore isn't something that disconnects us from the here and now. It is something that is fully engaged with the here and now, with the hustle bustle of the world. So the wild movement of the mind is only tamed when one lets go of the desire to bring that wildness into a state of complete rest. It's going with the flow, if you will. It's not resisting impermanence, but rather embracing it. It's mind that does this. The body has no choice. Right? We're just swept along. We're swept along in age. We're swept along in time and space. We have a hard time, the ordinary mind has a hard time fully associating with the spatial temporal body. Letting go of that ordinary mind in order to see the one mind is the teaching of the Buddhas. In our Zen tradition, we say that the original Zen transmission occurred mind to mind. When Shakyamuni held up the flower, the Udambara flower, and Kashyapa, depending on the account, either smiled or laughed. Here was the original transmission, a silent transmission. Dogen sees the endless continuity of the Dharma in which human beings become that flower, become other, become animal, become earth, become cosmos, and in this becoming, become one. Oneness is not a state that we attain. Oneness is becoming itself. When, though, we try to articulate this adequately, all of our metaphysically saturated language breaks apart, leaving us only the immediate experience, the direct experience. So those of you who are engaged in koan practice know that simply coming up with the conceptual answer, the good words, the witty response, that doesn't suffice. You have to answer with your entire being, with that undifferentiated mind. The transmission of Zen differs from other schools in Buddhism in that it goes beyond Buddha, as Dogen says, insofar as it leaves behind rational conceptualization or reliance on the sutra as a means by which we come to this realization. Bodhidharma, okay, the first Chinese Zen ancestor, the one that we often attribute the origin of Zen with, even though of course there's that other origin story going back to Kashyapa. Bodhidharma writes in the Wake Up Sermon that, quote, in India, the 27 ancestors only transmitted the imprint of mind. And the only reason that he, that is Bodhidharma, came to China was to transmit the instantaneous teaching of the Mahayana. That is, this mind is the Buddha. Elsewhere in another writing, the Bloodstream Sermon, he states, this mind is the Buddha, and beyond this mind, you'll never find another Buddha. To search for enlightenment or nirvana beyond this mind is simply impossible. The reality of your own self-nature, the absence of cause and effect, is what is meant by mind. Your mind is is nirvana. Again, what exactly is meant by mind here? One of my favorite Zen teachers is Huang Po. Huang Po was named after the place where he lived, Vulture Peak in China. If I recall, Su Yun was his Chinese name. And he lived in the 9th century. He was a successor of the famous Matsu. And though he acknowledges the inadequacy of this term, and the term being one mind, Huang Po draws a critical distinction between one mind and mind. In a work called the Chuncho Record, he writes, "All the Buddhas and all the sentient beings are but one mind, besides which nothing exists. This mind, which is without beginning, is unborn and indestructible. The one mind alone is the Buddha, and there is no distinction between the Buddha and sentient beings. But that sentient beings are attached to forms and so seek externally for Buddhahood. By their very seeking, they lose it. For that is using the Buddha to seek the Buddha. That is using mind, the ordinary mind, that is, to seek and grasp mind." Now, in the translation, the translator, Blofield, uses a small M and a big M to distinguish between these conceptions of mind, the ordinary mind and the one mind. As I understand it, Huang Po's main point here is that Buddha nature isn't something that can be located in a source other than ourselves. Shakyamuni was a Buddha, no doubt. But he was just Shakyamuni. Though we refer to him as the Buddha, and though he would refer to himself in his discourses as the Tathagata, or the world-honored one, this nevertheless does not mean that he is the source. This is why Linji, the famous Chinese Zen master known as Rinzai in Japanese, this is why he famously said, "If you see the Buddha on the road, kill him!" The Buddha is not a source. The Buddha does not exist outside of us. If you think that the one mind is an external reality, or assigned to it some sort of metaphysical stature, then what we've done is, what you do is simply turn it into something. You've made it into a substance. In which case, it cannot be Buddha nature, because Buddha nature is always empty. And it's empty because it's impermanent. We're reminded of this every time we chant the Heart Sutra. In his typically direct, bare-bones style, Bodhidharma describes the emptiness of the Buddha mind in the following way. "The nature of a Buddha's mind is basically empty. It's neither pure nor impure. She is free of practice and realization. She is free of cause and effect. A Buddha is someone who does nothing, who can't even focus her mind on a Buddha. A Buddha isn't a Buddha. Don't even think about Buddhas. If you don't see what I'm talking about, you'll never know your own mind. People who don't see their nature and imagine they can practice thoughtfulness or thoughtlessness all the time are nothing but liars and fools. They fall into empty, endless space. They're like drunks. They can't tell good from evil. If you intend to cultivate such a practice, you have to put an end to rational thought. To attain enlightenment without seeing your nature is impossible. To attain enlightenment without seeing your nature is impossible. A Buddha isn't a Buddha. All right, what are we to make of this? How do we see our nature if that nature is not something that is external, something that can be seen? This is what is meant by mind. Mind is emptiness itself and can only be transmitted as mind to others, mind to mind. It cannot be transmitted through any words, any teachings, through the sutras. This is why Zen always insisted on the close relationship between a teacher and student. And this has been the practice ever since Shakyamuni. Yes, it is possible to come to realization through one's own effort without a teacher. One assumes that this is what Shakyamuni did, but then later variations of his life said, well, he had 10,000 lifetimes before he finally reached his realization. Maybe somewhere along those 10,000 lives he had a teacher or two. But Huang Po says, it's only one in a million people that are capable of doing this. Why the teacher? Because the teacher is what confirms your own confirmation. Your realization is not simply a stamp that an other gives to you. If you do not already realize your own awakening, it is not there for another to recognize. That confirmation is simply a confirmation of your own confirmation. That is why it is mind to mind. Kashyapa knew already Shakyamuni confirms it. It wasn't that just because Kashyapa didn't say anything that Shakyamuni says, aha, you've got it, and Kashyapa can then say, ah, great, my big aha. No, he had the aha first. He had to have had the aha first. Because Buddha is already, it's not out there. It's with this awareness of the everydayness of practice that leads us to this confirmation. Why Dogen said that practice is realization. He used that in the same phrase, practice realization. It's with this awareness, and hence the original universality of awakened existence, that Dogen interprets this time-honored account of the first Zen transmission. Dogen writes, Shakyamuni Buddha's eyes were reflected in Mahakashyapa's eyes, and his eyes were reflected in the Buddha's eyes. This is the Buddha eye. This is the Buddha face. It's been transmitted face to face without a generation's gap until now. This is face to face transmission. A face to face transmitting Buddha transmits to face to face transmitting Buddha. It's transmitted from vine to vine without being cut. Transmitted from eye to eye with the eye open. Transmitted from face to face with the face revealed. Face-to-face transmission is given and received in the presence of the Buddha face. So let me just wind up here. Huangpo emphatically declares that the only dharma is that there are no dharmas, and that the dharma is only one mind. And he poses this dialectic in the Chuncho record. The question, if there's no mind and no dharma, what's meant by transmission? The answer, you hear people speak of mind transmission, and then you talk of something to be received. So Bodhidharma said, according to Huangpo, the nature of the mind, when understood, no human speech can compass or disclose. Enlightenment is not to be attained. And he that does gain it does not say he knows. Huangpo concludes, if I were to make this clear to you, I doubt that you could stand up to it. How are we to interpret that? When we realize that to fully realize mind is to let go of our conceptual linguistic understandings of it, it's then to set ourselves up to fully receive the teaching that resonates within ourselves because it resonates with everything else. That is the meaning of shunyata, I think. That is the meaning of interdependent origination. Emptiness is not nothing. Emptiness is all that there is. Thank you very much. Yes. Sure.
I think it was about partway through the lecture you were talking about the Buddha nature as the emptiness of permanence and the emptiness of the absolute, letting go of the absolute. And it reminded me of things I've heard sort of on the other side. I grew up in a Christian church. And they really seem to like the idea that there's a certain, you know, unshakable, absolute faith in the truth of salvation and a God. Do you think that that is the sort of fundamental philosophical difference between Buddhism and theistic religions? I don't know what your
I do. Yeah, I think that is a fundamental difference. Absolutely. It's not to say that all theistic religions necessarily take up that way of thinking or conceiving the absolute. But in general, I think that describes for the most part the Abrahamic religions.
Right.
Of course, you know, there are always exceptions, as there are within any tradition, and so no one can find within the Rhineland mystics, you know, people like Meister Eckhart or John of the Cross or, you know, some others, that standpoint that is very close to the standpoint of Zen. This idea of letting go, of releasement, of abandoning this notion of the absolute that leads to a position of non-willing. And I think that's really what the Zen standpoint is. The Abrahamic or theistic traditions tend to focus primarily on faith as the modality by which we relate to the absolute. Mm-hmm. In Zen, I think it really is a standpoint of non-willing.
Yeah. I wanted to mention to people that the ox herding pictures exist right over the front door in the center there, so when you walk out, you're right overhead. You can take a look, and the version we have doesn't end with the circle, but goes on to entering the marketplace with helping you.
More awakened version, huh? Yeah. Oh, these, what I'm passing around here are just some of the quotations that I cited today, in case you want to look back and refer to them. I'm afraid I spoke for a little longer than I expected, or maybe a little slower than I had anticipated, because I didn't get to a few of these. But that's okay. You know, all these words are empty anyway. So,
you know, Shudo Roshi is really fond of quoting another quotation from Dogen. You think your mind is concepts and ideas, but actually it's mountains and rivers and grasses and stones.
And yet, mind is very intimate, too. When we speak, for instance, words come out of nowhere unless we are rehearsing what we're going to say and then saying it. The stream of communication, trying to reach another person, is really coming out of nowhere. We don't have that next word in us.
It's something that we possess. Is that what you mean when you say we don't have it within us?
Yes, yeah, that it really comes out of nowhere.
Right.
And yet is coherent and characteristic of us, and yet something we've never done before.
You know, the philosopher Nietzsche said something very similar. Thoughts are not something that we possess. Rather, thoughts are what come to us. Almost suggesting, although of course this wouldn't be Nietzsche's line at all, considering his stance on the death of God, but as if they come from the outside. But that is, in a sense, I think, very close to what this notion of one mind that Huang Po was trying to describe. That this one mind is all pervasive. And therefore, the thoughts, the words that come to us, or at least appear to come to us, are not coming from an external absolute or from an other, because there is no other, but rather they are that which simply resonate within mind. And that's why the Dharma and all teachings are able to be communicated universally. Because that isn't something that arises out of one individual. The Buddha's Dharma, the Buddha Dharma didn't come from the Buddha. It already was. That's why when we take a look at the lineage, there's always those six cosmic Buddhas that are cited before we get to Shakyamuni. And they're symbolic of the fact that this Dharma is an eternal Dharma. And Shakyamuni, even if he is the Buddha of the age, is merely just part of that greater stream.
Yeah, he's never referred to as a great creative genius artist.
Yeah. Or
so you mentioned Meister Eckhart, and one of my favorite quotes, which I remember reading when I was in college, and it just really struck me, was this thing where he says, the mind with which I see God is the mind with which God sees me. And I was just wondering if you could comment on that.
Well, actually, I would refer to your attention to one of the quotes that's on this page that I just distributed. I think it's on the other side. I don't have a copy of it in front of me. But there's oh, thank you very much. I was rereading Chuangzi, and many of you, of course, are familiar with that famous passage about Chuangzi dreaming that he was a butterfly. A butterfly flitting and fluttering around, this is number 11, happy with himself and doing as he pleased. He didn't know that he was Chuangzi. Suddenly he woke up and there he was, solid and unmistakably Chuangzi. But he didn't know if he was Chuangzi who had dreamt he was a butterfly or a butterfly dreaming he was Chuangzi. Between Chuangzi and butterfly, there must be some distinction. This is called the transformation of things. I know that quotation from Eckhart, of course, very famous. And in Eckhart's mind, as I understand it, God and humanity are not the same. But God and humanity are so intimately linked that there is a veritable confusion. But I like to think of confusion here rather than just meaning a complete disarray of thought, but rather thinking of it in terms of a fusion, a confusion, a bringing together so that the identity of one term or the other can no longer be distinctly assessed. And that is being one with God. I ask God to rid me of God, he also writes. I ask God to rid me of God. Because only once God or Buddha is out of the picture can Buddha or God, if you will, be realized. So kill the Buddha. Get rid of God. That external God is, to use that Christian language, that is Satan. That is the adversary. That is the enemy. Get behind me. That's what Jesus says. Get behind me, Satan. That is not God. The absolute is not without. And I think Eckhart really comes very close in his own in his own way to realizing that. Which is why it's, you know, Zen isn't confined to those who profess belief in the Buddha Dharma. Zen is for everyone. Dogen says, geez, don't even talk about Zen. Don't talk about Soto. Don't talk about Rinzai. You start making these distinctions, you're nothing but a devil, he says. Let go of Zen. Let go of Buddha. So Buddha is not a Buddha.
Could you you say a little bit more about your use of the term wild mind? Every time I hear wild, I think of John Muir's famous saying, and wildness, was it Thoreau? And wildness is the preservation of the world. And so when I hear wildness used in other ways, it's kind of jarring. If I was hearing you a right or a wrong.
Well, I'd say on the basis of what you just said, more correctly than incorrectly. I like this phrase, the wild movements of the mind, because I think it really resonates with this idea that Roshi was so that Roshi was bringing to our attention today about our body being colonized by all these trillions of bacteria, that we are in a sense more non-human than we are human. And to think of the mind, or the self, rather, as the wild movements of the mind is a way of thinking of the self beyond simply the anthropocentric view that we normally have. That, I think, leads us to a deeper realization, a fuller realization, rather, maybe not deeper, but fuller, broader realization of dependent origination, our interconnectedness with all entities, human, non-human, sentient and non-sentient.
Have you thought about the fact that your last name is even wilder?
Yes, indeed. But when you were speaking, I think I misheard you, because I thought you were talking about the wild mind as the mind that hadn't realized what it was up to.
It is also that. It is also that, because that mind is the same on a fundamental level as the mind that has realized.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the mind that you use to get started.
Right. It's as much a part of that realized, awakened mind as anything else. It's when we let go of the idea of movement as progression from a state of non-realization or non-enlightenment to enlightenment. Already that, in a sense, sets up a path that's necessarily dualistic. And I think that's exactly what Huangpo and Bodhidharma and Dogen were warning us not to do. But it's one thing to conceptualize or state that, as we know. It's another thing altogether to realize and confirm it in our being. But there's nothing to attain. There's nothing to be realized. That is the paradox of awakening. The attainment of no attainment. Shakyamuni said that himself. I've attained nothing. But I think that is meant in the sense that I've not attained something that I did not already have before, or that I was not already before.
Maybe the popcorn stopped popping.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.